It's our third birthday.
Happy birthday, us. We'll be celebrating in a bumper birthday video coming soon, and we want to answer your questions.
So if you've ever wondered what our favourite facts are, or how we choose what events to cover, or why we got the giggles in a particular episode, now is your opportunity to ask.
Email us now at theretrospectors@gmail.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's April 18th, 1518, and another remarkable event is about to be uncovered by Aria, Rebecca, and Ollie. The Retrospectors.
Putting together the invite list for your wedding is always a tricky task. Will we upset people by not inviting them? A decision even tougher when the brief is, let's invite every important dignitary in Christendom. For today in history, in 1518 at Krakow Cathedral, was the union of Sigismund I, King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania, and Italian princess Bona Sforza.
Yeah, they must have looked like a bit of an odd couple. Her, a delicate Milanese woman, and him, a rugged, bearded Polish king, which was exacerbated by the fact that she was only 24 at the time, but her husband, who was known as King Sigismund the Old, was, true to his name, 51. So, you know, there was a bit of a difference between them in that respect. Polish chroniclers of the events were certainly struck by the bride, describing Bona as highly educated and beautiful, with blonde hair and very dark eyes.
It's what people always say, isn't it? As she made it down the aisle, we could all tell she was highly educated.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
she wore a dress made of blue Turkish satin, embroidered with little golden beehives, which some sources say were a symbol of her industriousness, but I feel like it's probably more likely to be some sort of family emblem. I don't know if you want to, like, advertise your virtues on your wedding dress. The groom wore a red cloak. The next day was like an entire day of reception. So they had the wedding and the coronation, and then there was a little party after that, and the next day was just a whole day of party. It ended with the consummation, which was kicked off by a ritual, we've discussed this before, in which the couple were accompanied to their chamber by a handful of selected guests, complete with bawdy humour, although from what I read, they did at least leave before the act itself got underway. And then, yeah, she took up her post as the Queen of Poland, and this was a huge change for Bona. She was coming from, being in the cradle of Renaissance humanism. She'd had a first-class education, you know, unusual for a woman at the time, but actually kind of unusual for anyone at the time. And then she came to Poland, and it has been overstated a little bit. She didn't bring the Renaissance to Poland. You know, Polish intellectuals already knew these things were happening, but she certainly did bring this whole new wave of Italian culture and thought and cuisine. Apparently, she was incredibly sick at first when she arrived in Poland because the diet was all heavy meat and root vegetables, essentially. She was like, where's the salad? And they were like, what's a salad?
Also, they had had one lunch that lasted 9 hours straight as part of their wedding that featured 29 courses and 1,500 different dishes served. So that may have contributed to her feeling a bit unwell.
She's like, oh, great, more venison and turnips.
Well, she actually grew her own veg when she moved in to his castle and was credited with introducing more vegetables to the Polish diet more broadly. In fact, the Polish word for vegetables still translates as things from Italy, which comes back to this moment where she brings her things from Italy to the Jagiellonian Empire. And it was an empire. It was a dynasty of royals that ruled over an area from Kiev to Prague, 12 modern-day nation states, Belarus, Ukraine, etc. All of that was part of Sigismund's domain. And the way in which that the Jagiellonian dynasty had actually expanded over all of that land historically was by marrying off their daughters to powerful European neighbours. In this case, it was marrying off the man to Italy, which, as you suggested, was kind of culturally relevant because of the Renaissance, but actually gave the Jagiellonians even more of a foothold across southern Europe.
Meanwhile, Bona Sforza was the second child of the Duke of Milan. Her mother was the Spanish princess Isabella of Naples, who some people think could have been the model for the Mona Lisa.
Oh, Great little tidbit.
She had perfect credentials, but her family weren't super important anymore. You know, they had the Duchy of Bari. They were connected to other duchies, but they weren't, you know, at the very top. They were unlikely to disturb the wider Holy Roman Empire. The King of Poland, Sigismund, had been widowed. He had two daughters, and he still needed a male heir, so a remarriage was advisable. She finally laid eyes on Sigismund just a couple of days before this joint wedding coronation. You know, it's interesting to think, you know, what did they make of each other? He was easily old enough to be her father, and she, despite what Polish commentators said chivalrously on her wedding day, she was famous for being pretty plain, you know. Probably neither of them was wildly excited, which makes it all the more remarkable that, despite all of this, it seems like the marriage was actually pretty okay, you know. They had six children, which obviously in this era is not necessarily a sign of a happy marriage, but the surviving accounts suggest that Sigismund really admired his wife. She was very intelligent, very energetic, and that he really respected her opinions.
Yeah, I mean, well, she had been well-educated. I know we often say this about princesses of this era, but actually, if you look at who her teachers were, the famous Italian humanists Antonio de Ferraris and Cristomo Colonna, she was interesting to be around, I think, you know, if you're a 51-year-old king of Poland. And it's interesting that the plainness that you describe. I don't think we have a fair representation of what she looked like, because the paintings of her fall into one of two categories. Either people who were ass-kissing her and made her look like the Mona Lisa, or people who despised her and made her look really very fat and unattractive. And she was actually wildly unpopular with quite a lot of people. She was kind of admired for her ability to participate in the decisions that Sigismund was making. But as ever with powerful women, there started to be rumours that she was actually making the decisions behind the scenes.
Yeah, one of the things that I found really interesting was that when she married Sigismund, he granted her several towns in Poland, which most people would probably have seen as a symbolic gesture. But she was very keen to get stuck in and start exercising as much personal power as possible. As you can imagine, this course of action didn't make her a lot of friends among the Polish aristocracy, who saw correctly that she was trying to sideline them from power. And she was also intensely invested in ensuring that their only son, Sigismund Augustus, would inherit the crown without incident. At this point, Polish kings were technically elected by the aristocracy, so much so that in 1530, when he was 10, he was crowned while his father was alive, indeed almost 20 years before his father's death, to secure his position. This practice is called vivente rege.
Two kings, nothing to see here, just a couple of kings, okay,
this,
you guys.
I mean, this was something that was technically possible under Polish law, but as you can imagine, wildly unpopular with the nobility.
But despite that, you know, she actually protected the country from one really significant threat, which was an attack from the Ottoman army. She had a correspondence with Harem Sultan, the legal wife of Suleiman the Magnificent, who was Polish, so she had an in there. In that letter writing, she was able to make it very clear that she was a real tub-thumping, flag-waving fan of the Ottoman Empire.
But all of this success came a little bit unstuck at the point at which her husband's health started to fail, and by 1548, he died at the age of 82. To bonus satisfaction, her 28-year-old son, also the king, succeeded to the throne peacefully. But soon, sadly, her relationship with her son soured, a fact that became obvious when his new wife, the Polish-born Barbara Radziwill, died in 1551. It was known that Bonner had opposed Sigismund Augustus's marriage to her, but public opinion accused Bonner of having poisoned the young queen, who actually died of cancer, so it wasn't her fault whatsoever. But despite the lack of evidence, she was pretty much driven out of town.
I mean, you look at it now and it's just outright misogyny, really. She was overly emotional. She was outspoken, hot-tempered.
Look, I admire her spunkiness, but she's probably a witch.
That was basically the vibe.
There's something really poignant about it. You know, 1556, she's 61. She goes back to Bari after almost 40 years.
It's funny though, isn't it? In Italy, no one took her journey in reverse in quite the same celebratory way. They weren't like, what are these, dumplings? We need a new word for this.
Her enormous wealth made her a coveted ally, and this was kind of her final undoing. She agreed to loan the Habsburg King Philip II of Spain 430,000 ducats, which some sources give as equivalent to 50 million euros today.
Yeah.
The problem was that Philip II seems to have had no intention to pay this back, and quite soon after, she fell ill with a mysterious stomach ache, which grew worse and worse over the next 10 days until her death in the early hours of the 19th of November 1557. Several members of her household staff sickened and died in the same period, which makes poisoning seem like the most likely cause, and the most likely suspect is a guy called Gian Lorenzo Papacoda, who was one of our most trusted advisors. But the theory goes that he had been enlisted on behalf of the Habsburgs. You know, they not only owed her a huge amount of money, they also openly wanted her land. They wanted the Duchy of Bari. And a will she made out a few days before her death under Papacoda's supervision left the duchies of Bari and Rossano, which she also owned, to King Philip of Spain. Dramatically, she then had one final rally before her death, during which she made out a new will, leaving them to her son.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Bona Sforza is still known by many Poles today because of the really shifting representation of her in popular culture over the centuries. You know, first there was this character assassination in her lifetime from the Polish and Lithuanian oligarchs. But over the centuries, that narrative began to shift and she was celebrated as a great leader who loved and advanced her adopted countries. And then this other narrative emerged in the 19th century, romanticized. A Sforza black legend, which is really well known and influential in Poland to this day, that has kind of both characteristics simultaneously. One, that she was very powerful, but also that she was a bit of a meddlesome hag.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, maybe she was a witch, but witches are kind of cool, no?
Yeah, exactly.
Tomorrow.
She hid on the sidelines until the starting gun and then kind of snuck into the pack. She was wearing a hoodie.
Ditch the ads and get a Sunday episode when you join Club Retrospectors. Patreon.com/retrospectors.